So I said on Thursday evening that we need the old stories. And today we are presented with a bunch of the old stories. I won't go into all of the old stories, but I think it's interesting that here we are, we're partway into Lent now, a whole week into Lent, and we're starting to get tired. Oh, it's hard. I miss those burgers and the steak and, oh, sorry about that. but you know, it feels difficult. And so we really need these stories of times when it was far more difficult and where men and women of faith were required by the circumstances that they found themselves in to sacrifice and to even potentially lay down their lives for what they believed. I don't have time to go into Moses or David or Samuel because I would be here all day. But I did want to at least mention Gideon and Barak, who might be slightly less well known than David and Samuel and Moses. Gideon, of course, finds himself, is met by an angel while he's threshing wheat in secret. This is not a great high introduction of the hero of the story. He's hiding from the Midianites, who are oppressing the children of Israel. And they come and they descend kind of like locusts upon them, and they take all the food that they can find because they're this wandering tribe, and they're so many of them. What can the Israelites do against them? And so what's Gideon doing when the angel finds him? He's threshing wheat in secret so nobody will find it. And the angel greets him and tells him that he's going to be a deliverer. Gideon, of course, make the story a little shorter, isn't quite sure about this. And so he asks God, are you sure? Like, I'm a pretty insignificant person here. And God in many ways shows him that he's sure that he's about his choice of Gideon. Most famously, the fleece, right? Gideon's like, okay, well, I just need a little more confirmation, God, that you're with us. And he's already seen a bunch of miracles, including the angel, like turning the food that he offers him into fire he's just like torn down idols and not gotten killed. So that's good. But he's like, oh no, I need a little more confirmation. So I'm going to put this fleece out on the ground. And I can't remember the order, but the first one was maybe that I want all the ground around it to be dry and the fleece to be wet. And so when he wakes up in the morning, lo and behold, all the ground around it is dry and the fleece is sopping wet. He picks it up and wrings it out and there's like a whole bunch of water in it. It's like, oh, wow. Okay. But that could be coincidence. Gideon's a man after my own heart. You know, just maybe it was just like happened to be an atmospheric phenomenon that imbued the fleece with all this water and didn't get the ground dry, wet. So okay, Lord, just to make sense, don't be angry, but just to make sure, next morning I'm going to put the fleece out again, and next morning I want the fleece to be dry and all the land around it to be wet. And of course, that's exactly what happens. It's like the fleece is bone dry and all the land around it is wet. He's like, okay, crap. I guess I have to go and attack the Midianites. And then so he puts out the word and they get like 30,000 men show up or something like that. Like a whole bunch of men. And God's like, there's too many. And again, I can just kind of hear Gideon thinking, what do you mean there's too many? The Midianites come down on us like locusts. Now, too many? And so God goes through this process of winnowing them out. And my favorite being like that he eventually, it's like the guys who are holding their spear in the right hand and then just bending down and drinking from their hand while they're watching. Only those guys are the ones who are going to stay. And Gideon ends up with only 300 men. And so 300 men against, well, and of course, when you think about it, it was never going to be decided by numbers. Even with 30,000 or 10,000 or whatever it was. The Midianites still way outnumbered the Israelites. So God is making a point here. It's like, okay, it's not about the number of people. And so he then takes his men, and he still is not sure. So God sends him down to the camp, and he overhears the Midianites having this dream, which confirms to them him that God is going to help him. Again, Gideon's a man after my own heart. and then finally he gets all the 300 guys together, gives them each a torch and a horn. Puts a jar, and they light the torches, but put the jar over the torches so that the light doesn't shine out. And then they surround the camp, and then all at the same time, they all smash the jars and blow the horn and shout out a sword for the Lord and Gideon. And all the Midianites wake up thinking that they are surrounded by vastly superior numbers. They leap up, draw their swords, rush out of the tent, and lo and behold, there's other guys with swords right there. And so they start fighting. And of course, they fight among themselves and kill all of themselves. And then it's a great victory. Or Barak, he's up against Sisera. And once again, the people of Israel are oppressed by forces that are beyond their ability to counter. In this case, Sisera has a whole bunch of iron chariots, which could be like tanks, right? In those days, and so they're up against these tanks with slingshots, right? and so Barak goes to the prophetess Deborah, and Deborah says to him, "Okay, well, assemble the children of Israel. You're going to go up against Sisera, and God will give you the victory." And Barak is likewise not 100% sure about this. And so he says, "Well, you know, you're the prophetess of Israel. I want you to come with me." And she says, "Okay, I'll come with you. But if I do that, the glory will go to a woman." And Barak is thinking, "I'm sure, well, you know, it's okay. Everybody likes Deborah anyhow. So, you know, there's no big shift here." And so he goes up against Sisera, and he wins, and Sisera flees, and Sisera is running away. And he comes up to this tent of this woman named Jael, and she says she invites him in. She's like, "Okay, you want to hide? That's fine. You can come in. I won't tell anybody you're here." He asks her for some water to drink, and so she gives him some nice warm milk, and he promptly falls asleep. And Jael takes a tent peg, big iron tent peg, and drives it with a hammer right through the temple of Sisera, and kills him. Some of these stories are pretty gross and gruesome, right? But this is the situation that the children of Israel found themselves in. And it needed a certain degree of faith that God was going to help them, because they're up against something that's far greater than they are. And we likewise find ourselves in our struggle up against something that's far greater than we are. We struggle not against flesh and blood, Paul says, but against principalities and powers, these great angelic beings in the high places who have dominion over whole swaths of the earth. This is the spiritual struggle. This is the warfare that we're engaged in. Now, fortunately, we can't see much of it. We're kind of blessed in that regard, because we'd probably be like Sam says to Frodo. He's like, "If we knew what we were getting into, we'd never have gone on this great quest." It'd just be too scary. But the thing is, we are not alone. We have the same God with us that was with Barak and with Gideon and with Deborah and with Samson and with Moses and with David. And if God is on our side, who can be against us? So our job is the same as it's always been. It is to be faithful. It is to have faith. It is to trust that God will preserve us and support us and defend us and enable us to persevere in what we have undertaken to achieve. Now, one of the things that we will find, all you have to do is read the old stories, is that this is not going to be easy. In fact, it will be more than just not easy. There will be forces against us that just kind of come out of nowhere. Like, what's going on? Is God judging us? And the answer, actually, if you read on in Hebrews, is yes. Yes, he is. At least that's how Christians and Jews have understood it all down through the centuries, is that God is at work in all of the circumstances that we find ourselves in, including the ones where it's like, wow, this seems totally random, and it's coming out of nowhere, and it's just kind of knocked me off my game. I just don't know what to do. Like, why, Lord? Why me? Why this? Why now? Right? That's always our question. And the answer is, God is disciplining us as sons. We've all had human fathers, and if they were good fathers, they disciplined us. You know, and no discipline is fun at the time, but we need it because we're kids. Like, and foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, and the rod of correction will drive it far from him. So we need this discipline from our fathers, our earthly fathers, and we still honor and respect them, or at least we ought to. And if so, how much more that the God, right, our Father in heaven. And this was always the understanding of the people of God throughout the centuries. When they looked at the Midianites and they saw them coming down, they realized this is a judgment of God. When they looked at Sisera and saw him and all his iron chariots, they realized this is a judgment of God on us. Now, I want us to be careful. We have to be a little bit careful in the sense that we don't necessarily know exactly what it is that I've done that has caused God to allow this to come into my life. Yeah, we can kind of go crazy with that, right? But if we understand that the stuff that happens to us that is negative and difficult and that makes it just harder to persevere isn't just random. It's not just a bunch of stuff. As the historian likes to say, one damn thing after another. It's actually something that is a divine blessing upon us if we understand it so and if we embrace it as such. I love the story of St. John Chrysostom when he was exiled, unjustly exiled by the emperor because he preached, I think it was because he preached against Eudoxia putting up this great silver statue of himself outside of his cathedral. Or one of those things. Anyhow, he was exiled by the empress, and after, like, a day or two after he had been kicked out of town, the whole city of Constantinople was shaken by a great earthquake. And everybody in the city assumed that this was the judgment of God on them for getting rid of St. John Chrysostom, and they brought St. John Chrysostom back. This is how the ancient world and even the ancient Christian world understood the hand of God working for our salvation in judgment on us at all times. And so if we embrace this way of thinking, now we can't impose it on anybody else. This is also dangerous. We had, after 9/11, you had certain Christian televangelists like standing up and saying, this is the judgment of God in us. And if we were a good nation, if we were a really truly godly nation, maybe that would have resonated with people. But, you know, we're not a Christian nation anymore. And neither us nor the U.S. are really a Christian nation. Well, maybe God, by God's grace, maybe one day. but you can't impose this understanding on anybody else. But we can embrace it for ourselves. And if we do that, then again, all those random things that seem to happen to us are suddenly not so random. Each one of them is a trial sent by God for me to prove my quality, as Sam would say, and to prove before God that I do really genuinely trust him, that I have faith in him. And that I have faith that he will preserve me and that he is on my side. And that ultimately, if he is for me, who can be against me? And this is the reason that we need these stories to encourage us. This is the reason that we surround ourselves with all of these images of all of the saints all around us as we worship. If we need a justification for having icons in the church, I don't know that there's any better justification than what we just heard. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. This is our mission in Lent. Let us embrace it, let us embrace one another, and let us endure until the end that we may be saved. To God, the glory of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, now and ever and unto ages of ages.